This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 14th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
From changing the perception of women's fashion journalism to shuffling through the latest September offers to setting sail on the high seas with a spinnaker made of paper, we're easing into autumn here on edition 55 of The Stack. Also on the show this week, we talk business all around the editorial floor, from features desk to photo desk. And while we do our tour, we hope to offer something of a masterclass in commissioning and assembling beautiful pages. And we'll also have a flick through a new book that is the industry covered.
Record sleeves and then CD sleeves were great records of the graphic and visual trends of a certain time. I think magazines also have that role. They've had that role for a long time, and they're one of the few things that are produced that retain that role.
And from Ladies' Wear to Lusophone, The Stack will be heading to Lisbon, where a new title looks to the oceans for editorial inspiration.
We start thinking here from nothing, from zero, trying to have this perspective from the sea. We can talk the sea in all perspectives, right? It's at the point.
All that and much more today on The Stack here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Tyler Brulé. It's been, as ever, a very busy week here at HQ and beyond. On Tuesday, we launched the Monocle Guide to Better Living here in London. Of course, that was after Berlin last week. On Wednesday, it was Amsterdam. And in a few hours, we'll be warming up the ink for a round of book signings in Tokyo at Tsutaya's Teesside branch in Daikanyama. From there, it's on to Hong Kong, Bangkok, Singapore, Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane before returning back to base to get our November issue out the door. You can find out more about our tour on our website, of course, or by signing up to our mailing list. But enough about us for today. Let's meet our guests around the table. Well, I was going to read this elaborate intro, which started with one magazine has changed the face of fashion editorial of late, blah, blah, blah. But I won't even do that because I'm happy to say that just Penny Martin of The Gentlewoman is around the table. And I believe when you were out in reception, I thought I spotted the new issue.
That's right.
Is it at least out in this country?
Yeah, UK newsstands yesterday, Friday, yeah.
And, actually, now I can see you've revealed there is a wonderful. Well, we all like a black frame, certainly this magazine anyway. You have a black frame. Talk us through a couple of the highlights.
Yeah, it's our biggest ever issue. It's huge, sort of heavy. I think our distributors are slightly cross with us that we've crossed the threshold of post. Huge piece on Léa Seydoux, who is our cover star, who's the star of the Cannes Film Festival winning film Blue's the Warmest Colour. But you may be interested to hear that our big piece on Martha Stewart made it in, so thank you very much for contributing.
Not at all.
Fabulous.
She was sitting in that very chair as well.
Gosh, I can feel the presence. The force. I think it's something like 16 pages. She looks absolutely amazing.
Was there a consideration that she could have got on the cover as well, or was it always going to be Léa that was going to...
It was always going to be Léa. We knew that she would be a very strong presence inside. And as you know, it's always about getting the balance that you don't feel like you've just stuck it on the wrapper and then there's nothing inside. I mean, she's very, very present inside. And there's some really other things I'm very pleased with. I interviewed Pat Cleveland earlier in the year for something else. And I knew as soon as I met her, one of the first black supermodels, of course, that she had to be in here. So Glenn O'Brien's done a really great interview with her for us. Clio Barnard, who was the winner of the Best European Film, The Selfish Giant, at Cannes as well. Somebody I've been chasing for a long time, Alison Moyet, Katie Hillier, who's become the...
What's Alison Moyet up to?
Oh, amazing. She just launched an album in May, a new electro album. It's really good. And she was very delighted to play it on set when she was being photographed, which I always love. I love when somebody will let us play their own music and see them sort of lip syncing while they're getting their lipstick done.
Hence why we do radio stations, right?
True. Yeah. So, no, it feels very sort of substantial and it feels a little bit like the magazine's become what we were hoping. So the fashion's very advanced. advanced, and I've got lots of essays about the politics of public conveniences in London and so on. So there's lots of ideas in there for you.
And I also want to just talk about the sheer size and weight, and congratulations for Crossing being sort of very naughty, hitting that threshold that, of course, as you said, publishers hate when these things get a little bit too heavy, they don't go through letterboxes, etc. I also want to introduce, a new voice around the studio table, something of a familiar face, at least for all of the people who are here in our Wink Creative Days at the agency. Stephen Ledger-Lomas, a new voice here on the stack, studied photography at the Arts Institute in Bournemouth and began his career as Rankin's production manager. This was followed by 2 years as art buyer at our sister company, Wink Creative, before he moved to Dazed and Confused as photographic director. He's also done time at Mother, but currently he is at MAP, of course, a photo agency here in London. First, I have to say welcome back. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Tyler. Good to be here.
What's sort of going on, would you say, if we look at sort of the Brother magazine, to Penny's great story about Alex Calderwood and everything he's doing with Ace out east in London. And then also sort of, a lot of people talking right now about, from a creativity point of view, has there been too much sort of focus on digital and too much emphasis right now on, just become sort of the new land of tech? Does that sort of push agencies like yours somewhere else? Give us the 1 minute read.
The landscape, yeah. That's the enormous question. We're at an interesting point, I think, in terms of creativity within UK advertising, especially. Clients have been investing an awful lot in digital. Obviously, there's a huge debate around social media and where we should take that in terms of advertising work. I think...
What type of debate are you hearing? And we'll come back to the rest of it, because it is always a fascinating discussion that, of course, comes up probably sort of, every other program. And it's interesting, one thing that we hear from brands right now is a lot of people are saying it's a bit of a time of reckoning right now. I was talking to a big footwear company on the athletic side who said, maybe we pushed too far. And in fact, we've lost our position in magazines because we really quite literally sort of stepped over the line, and now we can't get our outside back covers back anymore.
There's probably an awful lot of truth in that. I think there was a point at where the internet became prevalent in terms of the work clients were doing. They really pushed a lot of spend in terms of media into digital, purely because you can have a small idea which becomes very large. And I think when something snowballs in terms of social media, it's appealing to clients. And print advertising was suddenly seen as a bit of a dusty relic of the advertising age. There are whole cities in America now where billboards are being torn down day by day because this kind of two-second media is difficult for the customer to engage with. But I think we've come to a point, enormous clients have really spent an awful lot of money on social media and Facebook strategies. And they're left at a point where they have 25,000 likes on a Facebook page, but what does that actually mean for the brand? A lot of the craft, I think, has really left print advertising purely because resources have been focused elsewhere. And, clients such as Nike quite often give briefs to creative agencies now where the acorn of the idea has to be, that's advertising, horrible advertising lingo there, has to be within digital so that, and it has to explode from there. I never thought I'd say these sorts of words, but
here they are. Yeah. Penny, I wanted to ask, so much of not necessarily what you've done, but when we look at all of our magazines, oftentimes, the photographer was able to go out on a big photo assignment for a very big brand, and it's not news to anyone, but over the decades, there was always an extra day that was tacked on to go and do a photo shoot for a much loved magazine, oftentimes by those brands. And that's also, what fuels a large part of the newsstand. Do you think there's been any impact, and whether that's sort of, swinging up or swinging down in terms of getting people to, to still go out and do things and for a decent budget? Because it's interesting with all of these cutbacks that we've seen.
What I'm hearing is with the magazines that are trying to be shoppable, that the agents are turning around and saying, well, this is a slightly different prospect and a different consideration. And some of the figures that are being quoted for what's a sort of quasi-editorial shoot and isn't. Basically, the agents are standing up for their artists and asking for quite a pretty penny, and I think it's quite a shock. One of the things I wanted to mention, to twist it back to magazines from advertising slightly, was I don't know if you both of you saw a very interesting piece that Eric Wilson wrote in the New York Times, a sort of digest of the September magazines. talking about basically how shocking many of the monthly magazines front of book now is, because they're so sort of paralyzed by the response, the pressure to respond to online, that the front of book just looks like a really bad sort of shopping page that's online, and how poor the editorial standards are. And what from my point of view, what a surprise it is for some of the kind of blue chip editorial magazines to be so scared by online that they're not exercising the standards that they previously did, you know. And some of it's true. Some of the monthlies that you read, I'm not going to mention who they are, but we know who we're talking about. That would never have made it past the proofreaders before, but it's as if likes are exerting the authority and not the sub-editors, you know. And there's these kind of terrible little pieces about that are so product-led as to be totally facile. And I feel like actually that's the interesting point in editorial at the moment, is that the front of book is in crisis. It's got to rewrite itself into something substantial. I mean, I would say that, of course, because I don't have shopping pages at the front of my book and I'm very personality centred, but I'm really patting myself on the back or sighing a heavy sigh of relief that we didn't go down that line, because, you know, it's being heavily criticised and I think the readers are very literate of it. They know exactly what's being done, you know, and how poor it looks.
Stephen, I don't want to, you know, for you to betray any clients, and well, I mean, we all have clients in this room, but I'm wondering, do you sometimes sit in meetings, and I feel that there's always sort of a push for sometimes, you know, people to say, okay, but yes, you want to do this editorial idea, but somehow can you integrate our brand? And it's like, I mean, yes, we might be able to shoot your clothes, we might be able to do something with your car, but we're not integrating it. And yet they still ask, they try to, you know, refashion the question in a completely different way. But, well, but can we do it like this? But it's like, well, this is still advertising and there's a separate set of costs. And, you know, there is, of course, you know, the agent in between, the photographer that we want to commission. And these are going to be a very separate set of fees. Oh, no, but it's, you know, but it's going to be sort of, it's going to have a great editorial adjacency. Like, yes, we understand that. Yeah. We've been doing this for a very long time. Do you sometimes also have to blow the whistle at, you know, with the client sitting in an agency saying, we can maybe have that discussion with the TV network or the magazine you want to go into, but this probably just isn't going to fly. I sort of sense that sense of trying to, you know, to bleed, you know, continues, you know, to happen, you know, month in and month out. And I often sort of, and we can see the magazines that are doing it, and yet you're saying, no, this simply can't happen.
I mean, there's an enormous grey area, isn't there, within magazines, especially advertorials, paid advertorials, where that blurs between between editorial. But I mean, a lot of the clients, purely because of the suck for content. I mean, there are so many platforms now, and so many brands have their own sites, which, you know, they need to supply. It's a hungry beast, really. The production budgets have collapsed in a lot of areas, and a lot of clients really, you know, the prevailing attitude within some of the kind of big global network clients are that photographers or illustrators should really be working with them for the cachet of working for that name. And it puts agencies in a very difficult situation, because if you can't be paid by, that was the point where I was going to insert the name, then who can you be paid by? I mean, that's the money end of the industry. Editorial is a showcase for gaining that type of work. And if suddenly you're not going to be paid for that, then where do you go as a professional?
We're going to take a very, very short break. We're talking to Penny Martin, editor of The Gentlewoman, and Stephen Ledger Lomas from Mother. We're back after this. And you are listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Well, it's hard to try and collate the very best in print media, of course, for your listeners. We certainly attempt it every now and then on this program. Well, now, thanks to a very regular contributor here on The Stack, Jeremy Leslie, he has almost done the impossible in the form of a book which he talked about a couple of weeks ago. We had a very, very small preview, but now we have a much larger one. The Modern Magazine, Visual Journalism in the Digital Era, offers an in-depth but suitably flick-friendly look at the industry. Earlier, our David Pleasant spoke to Jeremy to preview the book.
I've done a few books in the past, not for some time, and I'd been planning, thinking of doing another book for some time, and I felt I had one in me. I'd been writing a lot on the blog about magazines and observing a lot of changes and developments, and I just thought that there hadn't been a proper magazine that took an overview of what was happening currently in the field. For some time, there'd been several books looking at very specific areas, but I felt that enough was happening creatively in magazine publishing, and also that so much of the discourse around the subject tended to be about the decline and negative stories, and I wanted to move on from that. And the title is very deliberately label-like. It is The Modern Magazine. It just supposes that it's self-evident that there are, you know, there is such a thing as the modern magazine, and I hope it portrays that well.
Is it an industry book, do you think, that you've created, or is it for the outsider as well? It's quite specific. Who do you think is going to really delve into this book and relish it?
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm sure listeners to the Stack will relish it and enjoy it. A lot of people involved in the industry will enjoy it. But I think there are multiple industries to which the book can apply. In my day-to-day job, I sort of have feet in two camps, both in the pure magazine editorial design world, but also in the more general graphic design world. And one of the things that drew me to magazines in the first place was an interest in graphics and the way that perhaps once upon a time, record sleeves and then CD sleeves were great records of the graphic and visual trends of a certain time. I think magazines also have that role. They've had that role for a long time, and they're one of the few things that are produced that retain that role. They are, you know, they are kind of like the rings in a tree in terms of measuring things. So I think that I hope a lot of the work in there will appeal beyond just pure magazineaholics to people that are interested in design and things that are going on in a more deeper way.
And if we kind of talk beyond kind of magazineaholics, as you put them, and I mean, it's kind of, I think it's a bit of a fine line, because there's probably plenty of people out there who might consider themselves addicted to certain titles or whatever. Do you think there is this new trend in terms of the reader and the magazine that's kind of creating a reader very much in the image of the magazine? So it's kind of, you're leaving the reader really in a point where they really can't wait for the next issue. And, and I mean, is there something of that theme within some of the titles that you feature?
I think in a lot of them, I think that's one of the fundamental things about magazines and the appeal of magazines. I think perhaps it's something that's been forgotten in recent years. I think there's been a mass boom in magazines until relatively recently. A lot of the big publishers have gone all out for huge sales to the detriment of the form. I think a lot of people have lost touch with what the real kind of essence of magazine can be. And a lot of the independents and the more interesting magazines I've featured in the book are feeding back into that. I've spoken before about the way that magazines like the New Musical Express, when I was younger, they were my Facebook. They were my source of a community of finding out where gigs and new records, etc., were happening and where I could meet like-minded obsessives. Magazines are community builders. They always have been. But I think there is a new rediscovery of that in a lot of the examples in the book.
And so you see that maybe some of the there's that kind of resurgence. So people kind of are looking to a magazine for maybe to connect with something that they feel isn't offered in any other kind of media outlet. Would you say?
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't separate magazines from other outlets. I think it's very important. And in fact, some of the more interesting examples in the book do rely on the digital side of things as well in very intelligent ways. I mean, I think, interestingly, earlier this week, the CEO of Hearst Magazines referred to the fact that they were looking more for cross-channel relationships with their readers, where they're much more about having a fewer really focused, hard engagement relationships with those readers rather than going for the mass market. And I think that's the way forward, is to use the magazine alongside other streams to really build a close relationship with people and build that community.
And in terms of the, obviously, design is a huge part of it. If we can describe the book, it's a kind of very mixed bag in terms of there's whole spreads, there's several spreads of a magazine. It's kind of a very, I don't know, there's something very pure and simple about the design of the book. It must have been quite a challenge to try and capture such a diverse set of publications within one book. I mean, how did you go about actually putting it together visually?
There were two things on my mind. One was simplicity, because I think when you're displaying lots of other people's creative work, you need to let it speak for itself. And there are plenty of examples of books which have been perhaps over-designed to the point where the book overwhelms the content. I wanted the content to speak for itself. It was also really important to me that the book reflected what I believe in terms of print, and that is make the most of it. So I was very keen to choose the paper carefully and to choose the presentation in terms of the nature of the cover and the cut-down hardback binding. I hope it feels like a good item as well as reads and looks like a good item. In terms of the planning the content, there are five chapters, but largely the images flow from image to image. It's like a sort of carefully paced picture story involving magazines that I've researched.
And I just have to say, it really, it's kind of, there's something almost like the kind of magazine industry looking in the mirror at itself. It's a wonderful read or a wonderful flick. Finally, if we could just kind of perhaps look forward, you've touched on it a little bit, the kind of industry magazine trends and so on. You've now become one of our top magazine experts and reviewers on the show. What do you think's next for the industry, independent magazines and others?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? If there was a simple answer. I think, for me, the fascinating sort of background to this book is that where once it was a very simple industry with a very simple model that most people are capable of following and making hay on, it's a much more complex world now, to the point where everybody has to work out their own strategy and their own way through it. And I think there are multiple examples and multiple ways of people that have both succeeded and failed. So I think, for me, part of the excitement, the creative excitement at the moment is that nobody quite knows what's going to work. So everybody's trying lots of things, and that's thrown up lots of intelligent, interesting ideas and lots of ideas that frankly have flopped. But along the way, there's lots of ideas out there that are happening and being discussed. So for me, I mean, that's the way forward now, is to remember that you're trying to build a relationship with the reader. And I think people, you know, people will perhaps not realise it, but they have forgotten that in recent years. And people are rediscovering that and trying to establish who their reader is and work out the best way to communicate with them.
And Jeremy, tell us, we're all looking forward to a conference that you are putting together, the Modern Magazine, that bears the same name as the book. Tell us a little bit about what's on the programme.
Well, the conference takes place a few weeks after the actual publication of the book, and the idea is that it marks the publication. I wanted to do something above and beyond the book just emerging. And we've got designers and editors. We've got Richard Turley, the designer behind Bloomberg Business Week. We've got Justine Picardy from Harper's Bazaar here in the UK. We've got Tyler from The Stack, of course. And a host of others, including several of all of our favourite independent magazine people.
And that was Jeremy Leslie talking about his forthcoming book, The Modern Magazine, which is published on the 23rd of September. It's by Lawrence King. And indeed, as he mentioned as well, big conference coming up as well on the 16th of October. And I will be putting an appearance to chat there as well. I wanted just to, Stephen, just go over to you from an agent's point of view. It's interesting when Jeremy says, you know, you have to make the most of it, which of course sounds like the most obvious thing. It's amazing how many magazines aren't making the most of it. You think you should be maxing it out when it comes to paper, your trim size, and of course all of the people that you're commissioning as well. Do negotiations become, you know, more difficult on the editorial side in terms of what people are willing to pay? And I guess the next part of that is there also, we're talking about sort of the devaluation of print slightly. You know, is it coming sort of slightly full circle? And Penny, you know, you're mentioning as well that people are sort of pushing back if it looks a little bit too commercial and shoppable. Well, you need to pay a different price. And I'm wondering what happens, you know, in terms of art desk discussions, you know, with the agent now.
It's a complex world. I mean, MAP, the agency I'm currently at, represents photographers in New York and London and Sydney. And those are huge marketplaces for magazines. I mean, we've seen an enormous boom in independent titles. There are some fascinating independent launches. And then there is the traditional kind of fashion elite and newcomers. You have to assess every opportunity as it comes in. I mean, is it an enormous celebrity market? Some photographers want to shoot celebrities for no budget because they're allowed to resell the images. Some photographers are interested in the cachet of working with a very new, independent, interesting title. It's tricky because London and New York especially, that there are virtually no budgets really left in most magazines, and photographers invest an enormous amount of their own money in there because it is this, you know, traditionally it has been this shop window for picking up commercial work. It's a different age in terms of publishing now.
Penny, your view on the idea of when we would assume that, you know, yeah, we should always sort of be maxing it out, you know, when we can. Where do you think this sort of like the indecision or just, you know, just the lack of courage that people sort of say, well, it makes sort of total sense. We're going to cut here. We're going to put more, you know, towards digital. You know, can you save 15%, you know, on your photo budget? I mean, in one way, he's saying everyone's sort of trying to find it out. But I also sort of listened to that thinking, you know, was it ever thus as well?
Maybe it's part of a kind of overall shift in attitude to journalism and imagery because of online, and maybe it's been denigrated by the fact that it just seems so omnipresent and so quickly turned over, you know. And I wonder whether people will look back at this period in history and, you know, in some places and look for the kind of definitive Avedon photography or the amazing long form journalism and look at our mainstream magazines and wonder why on earth they're not publishing it and why it's these kind of pages of kind of repurposed online street photography images. Now, they've got their place, but it's strange that we've been so quick to just throw away something that we're working up for like 100 years as the kind of definitive, most beautiful, most seductive expression of our times and our clothes and our attitudes and our beliefs. And then, you know, kind of be reduced to kind of love the shoes. You know, how did that happen in 5 years flat? You know, it's astonishing. But I don't want to kind of tailspin into a negative rant. That isn't my experience, is the lucky thing. I meet our readers at readers' events, and you have them too. And they say, I love that you give so much room and so much thought and so much time that is so developed. And I think that a lot of the good magazines are realising that this is their opportunity to be different, to concentrate on quality. I mean, it's not that hard. This is what we did in the 60s and 70s. I think let's just stop, turn around and go back to what we were good at. And I don't think that's too difficult. And, you know, and I think the clever people understand that.
Here, here. That wasn't a rant either. It was good. I think it was warming up for one. We are going to go away for a very, very short break. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, a lot more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations and stunning photography, we look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shubiken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in all good bookshops around the world, and you can also order it at monocle.com. Happy reading!
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24. Our guests today are Penny Martin of The Gentlewoman. She has the brand new issue sitting right in front of her, and also Stephen Ledger Lomas from the photo agency MAP here in London, many other bases around the world as well. Stephen, I'm going to throw you into the hot seat. You have Marfa Journal. Set us up with the title and why you brought it in today.
We kind of touched on it briefly then, but I'm looking at a bit of a celebration of independent publishing. And Marfa Journal is a brand new magazine by artists for artists. Make of that what you will. It's a slightly obscure title, which features a bit of a who's who of young New York artists. But it's actually an English title, I believe. And it was set up after a trip to Marfa, Texas, which is obviously, you know, synonymous with Donald Judd and a particular type of art scene. It's an interesting title. It features Tim Barber, Carly Ciottino. It's the epitome in some ways of a certain New York aesthetic. But what I love about it is it's so irreverent and the design is so challenging. And we talked before about celebrating print, and I think this celebrates print in a very different way. It kind of ignores a lot of the traditions of traditional editorial. I'd be very interested to know what Penny thinks of it with the... She's looking fascinated from across the table.
I'm just wondering who makes it.
It's Alexandra Gordienko is the editor, and it's literally an independent title set up by her. One of the other titles I have here with me is Hurt You Bad, which is a graffiti title which features no graffiti whatsoever. And there's an interesting interview with Freddie Fraser Forsyth, who's the editor-in-chief of that magazine. At the end of it, he's asked, do you have any advice to pass on to anyone else who wanting to start up their own magazine? And his advice is just do it. It's easier than it ever has been before. There is no barrier to entry, which I think is quite an interesting proposition.
Mm. How do you feel about that? Because, of course, we see this just incredible spike in the number of independent titles, you know, and, you know, all of those things are fine. Yeah, barrier for entry is easy as long as your pockets are deep enough or there's someone sitting in the background. You know, of course, it's faster and there are more outlets and you can market it directly yourself, et cetera, et cetera. But you still have to pay the print paper and ink bill.
Exactly.
And maybe you don't have to pay your contributors, but there are some physical costs that you can beg, borrow and steal for, but not all the way.
Yeah, I imagine so. Some of these titles, I imagine, don't have a particularly long life, but I also enjoy titles which are literally a flourish in the marketplace, and they come out and they may, these titles might not be here in 2 years' time, but they exist, and they exist as a as an interesting piece of evidence from our time. And I think that that in itself is interesting enough. Whether Marfa Journal makes it onto the next issue or not, it remains to be seen. But it's a very entertaining title. It's worth seeing.
Penny, your impressions?
I think it's a magazine I'd need to spend more time with, because I can see it's very well supported, and it's very much a kind of collection of a variety of different viewpoints. You know, our magazine isn't really a container for a variety of perspectives. It's only got one perspective. And I've got really into that kind of approach to magazine editing, kind of absolutely knowing who you're speaking to because you're speaking to somebody that you know and that's like yourself. And I don't know this reader, and I'm just trying to work out who it
you're
is.
You're trying to place yourself at the launch party, maybe? Or
yes, I'm just looking at the various women without their bottoms on and wondering who they connect with. But it's definitely, I can see it's a part of a scene, but I'm just trying to imagine who that is. And that's the interesting question that we were talking about earlier, kind of how you aim to connect with your readership and what you're sort of saying to them.
A little bit earlier, at the top of the show, you were saying that you've almost felt that this current issue of The Gentlewoman has hit stride almost. Is the validation of just, of course, it's not just sheer volume that it's your biggest issue. That could be part of it. But when you talk about that sort of singularity in voice, you feel that you've actually honed that more and more now.
Well, I mean, you'll have to be the judge of that, readers. I think personally, I feel that, you know, of course, you every time you produce a magazine, you're looking back through it for the weakest link, and you always know what the team felt maybe didn't work perfectly. And I feel that it's not perfect, but I feel that I understand who that's speaking to, and I know who's going to enjoy it. And that makes me feel very sort of satisfied. And it also, it has happened in parallel with a point where we're starting to think, you know, having resisted doing anything online, I sort of finally started to realise what our online presence would be. And it wasn't about content delivery. I feel that the content delivery is one thing that's very specific in the magazine. And I've started to think about a lot more about creating a sort of club for readers. And it's, I mean, something, if I may say, is you do very well. You know, I've been to the events where you mix your readers in with your contributors, which I always think is incredibly sophisticated. And we started to try it in a sort of small way when we launched the issues. And it's been incredibly fruitful meeting people that read your magazine. I mean, it sounds like a no-brainer, doesn't it?
But it's incredible how many publishers, when you go out and talk to them, say, do you really get your photo editors in front of your readers? Like, yeah, of course we do. And yet, I don't know if other publishers just can't be fact to do it. And oftentimes it's when you're speaking to the serious players of scale and just think, you know, do you become so big and you're focused on so many other things? Maybe it's too obvious that you don't do it, or it's just too cumbersome and maybe it could be too awful because you don't want to hear what they have to say.
Well, you know what it's like. You can become in your office copy editing your entire year, or you actually meet the people that you meet the rest of the industry. And then the next step is, you know, the editors could actually be standing talking to the people that buy their magazine. And lo and behold, they're actually hedge funders that tell me all about this amazing woman that breeds horses and God, you should meet her. And actually, you know, they're just as well placed to editorially devise your magazine as you are. So, you know, I've had some of my best ideas as a result of doing this. And to answer your question, I just know that the magazine we've produced would satisfy and please those people. Mm-hmm. And that feels really fulfilling for me.
Why do you think that is, Tyler? Why do you think that these magazines are kind of scared of meeting the audience? Because it strikes me as quite ironic in a way that Condé Nast probably spends hundreds of thousands of pounds a year with research groups in strange places up in Derby with 10 people sitting around looking at various covers. Why aren't they not engaging directly with their audience?
I mean, I think that that's just it, because there is someone on the fourth floor, you know, down the third hall, and they're responsible for that. You know, and I think, you know, so many titles become so compartmentalized that you're always amazed how unentrepreneurial, you know, so many titles are. And maybe because, you know, I think in some editorial environments, you're not allowed to be entrepreneurial on the editorial floor. You're supposed to save money and you're supposed to be able to manage your budget and all of those things. But are you allowed to think about innovation on the newsstand and what you could do in terms of readers' events or even how you could, you know, develop a more interesting advertorial for clients? Maybe not. And I guess maybe if we sort of think of maybe this current phase that we're in publishing, I think, you know, I've always believed, you know, really good journalists, good photo artists, you know, they're all great salespeople. They're the best salespeople, in fact. And it's good having a great ad team, of course, can structure it and close the deal and manage it all. It's nothing better than having Penny go out and probably, you know, do your thing in front of whoever it is, you know, agency, brand, you know, anywhere in the world. I mean, are you really going to have someone on your ad team who's going to do it better? I doubt it.
Yeah. And it's that sense of, you know, being in the room with the person. You just, you know, you smell the answer, you know, you just sort of need to be there. And And also it makes it much more pleasurable for you as well. You know, it's been a good experience.
I guess the other side, do you get those invitations, Stephen, as well, to mix and mingle with other titles as well? And of course, you know, you're going around and you're picking up the phone, dealing with photo editors and art buyers, et cetera, all over the place. But how much do you also feel that you get back to close to an editorial floor as well to just see where the innovation is and you know what your clients are looking for?
I don't think we do. I think it's tricky because obviously as an agent, you want to go out there and meet as many people as possible, but we're separated by the ocean of email these days, and it's not often you actually get to engage with the clients in that way. I think it's really important because I think it's then you truly understand how these collaborations are going to work. I mean, Gentlewoman's built up a beautiful aesthetic through years of, you know, collaboration with artists, and that's, you know, they yield the best results. And I think it's really about those personal relationships, and that's what Monocle seems to do really well when they do hold these events.
I wanted to just talk about, of course, there's a design aesthetic which you've very much stuck with, but also wanting to work with the new photographer versus, you know, sticking with the people who were with you in the very beginning as well. And what is that tension like?
Well, that comes back to what I said about having a very clear perspective. You might think that, you know, any magazine would want to just represent new talent, but actually it takes a long time for people to understand the way we want to represent women and what would be a compromise. And actually, I'm not going to say there's few people that could work with us, but we're pretty demanding and we need a very clear idea. You know, one of the great pleasures that's happened as a result of working closely with advertising is that American Apparel shoot a specific advert for us because clearly their artwork wasn't in line with the rest of what we were producing in some places, you know, and that's the kind of relationships on the advertising side. But, you know, in terms of photography, there were a whole lot of people, for instance, that were very outraged that we would use Terry Richardson to shoot Angela Lansbury. And he's an incredibly sophisticated photographer that understands the politics of what he does, and, you know, only he could have got that look out of that woman's eyes, you know. So I think that it takes a long relationship to understand that trust and put certain people in certain photographers' hands, and I think that you can't just try somebody out with certain kinds of women, and we wouldn't. So actually, you might look at our pool of photographers relatively small in comparison with comparable publications, and there's only a few photographers that really can not just do it to that standard, but with all the other considerations.
Patty, I want to turn to some of the magazines that you've brought in a moment. We're going to take a very short break. We're going to jump off to Lisbon when we come back from this short little sting. And you're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, Penny Martin and Stephen Ledger-Lomas. Now, let's get to water and head to Lisbon. The presence of the ocean is key to the Portuguese, dictating everything from leisure time to regional cuisine, as well as being a source of some of its major industries. It seems timely then that a new magazine, now Benchi celebrates its national asset, but without restricting itself to just national issues. The ocean is everywhere, and as editor Isabel Lucas tells Sima Tariq, it provides endless content for a print publication that bravely explores the seven seas.
It was the name of a Portuguese ship used in the 15th century to discover the whole world. And now we have the same name here in the 21st century. It's looking at the future.
Editor Isabel Lucas is explaining the name behind new magazine Nau 21, or Ship 21, in the publication's small studio in central Lisbon. With cafe-goers and afternoon diners below, her small team of four dream up stories, ranging from fashion and food to politics and science, that all have the ocean as their main theme. The monthly magazine is now coming up to its fourth edition, currently printing at 10,000 copies.
We started here, at this table, in Chiado, talking about the sea, Portuguese sea. Some guys from Açores, the islands, came to us, to Vasco Colombo, the art director, and they want to make a review, a magazine. So it's not a very, very good time for that, for thinking about that, but we think a lot and we say, yes, this is the time, why not? And we start thinking here from nothing, from zero, trying to have this perspective from the sea. We can talk the sea in all perspectives, right? It's at the point. I'm a journalist. I work a lot with culture, literature, and I make interviews. I'm not a scientist, nothing like that. But I can look at the sea in this perspective. I'm a journalist, so I want to tell stories, I want to tell sea. And we are starting to talk to each other, me and Vasco, Raquel Porto, it's the other designer. All this, it was putting the paper in 2 months.
With oceanographers as consulting experts, the magazine, which just uses 2 fonts and balances large image-led features with text-heavy essay pages, is formulated according to the theme of the cover issue, the most recent focusing on the question of the ocean as Portugal's biggest brand. As photographers, academics, illustrators and writers jump at the chance to be involved, Isabel believes their project is attracting quality contributors for a new generalist audience.
The times are very difficult, so this is the big challenge. But we have one thing that I'm proud right now. It's people that came to me to want to write at this magazine. They are seniors, they are people that write very well. They are good photographers, the best ones want to write here. We have Pedro Gadanho, one of MoMA's directors. He writes here about architecture and sea. We have also this, for example, this is Alexandra Prat Coelho. She's from Público. It's one of the founders of Público. She writes very well. She knows a lot about Portuguese products and all of that. So it's nice. I don't like to choose people because they are all so good. José Vegar, it's another regular. He has a section that we want to launch some discussion about what can you expect, what can we expect from the Portuguese ports. We have a great writer in the last chronicle. It's Afonso Cruz. It's one of the great writers right now. We have Viriato Surmanho Marques. It's a great thinker of politics, ambience, all of that.
Can you tell me a little bit about the next issue, or is it a secret?
Oh, no, it's not a secret. We're going to talk about pirates, the new piracy of the oceans. It's one of the issues. We have also the surf championship. They are going to be in Peniche in October. We have also that. Some people, some colleagues, they are very concerned sometimes when they speak to me. Oh, that must be very difficult to get some issues, to get themes. How can you get? That's the more easy. I don't have that concern. What concerns me right now is it now gonna sail?
With selected text in English and ample potential to reach the rest of the Lusophone world, Now Bintium is a unique new publishing project that is already pushing the boat out. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Simon Tarrick.
Well, there you go. One, a bit of a focus and following a vision, Penny. I mean, you know, you've got a magazine like Now 21, as translated. You know, at first glance, you sort of think, okay, well, you'd be running out of steam quite literally on the high seas, maybe after 6 or 7 issues. But we are just talking about that German magazine Mare as well, which is, you know, it's quite this incredible franchise in Germany, just around all things, not just sea, anything to do with water. And it can work.
When you mentioned it, I thought it was just a portfolio of kind of images of the horizon. But of course, you forget there's the industry and there's the food and the politics. I was brought up on the coast and obviously there's all the drinking. You know, there's many different facets. Quite an interesting Trojan horse for a lot of different editorial ideas.
Yeah, I mean, you could even get, you know, boys in sort of tight, bright tights as well. I mean, if you want to. Steve, for first impressions, I mean, I know you were saying, of course, you know, photographers, or Penny was saying they don't mind horizon. You were chiming in saying absolutely. But I mean, they go much further than that.
I think so. And I think it's one of those magazines which you see and think, oh, why didn't I do that? It's one of those kind of great thematic matter. I think looking at Jeremy's book, just about reinventing genres in that way, like Carl's Cars, and they did what that did for cars, and it's such a beautiful theme to base so much around, as you said, Penny. I mean, you can imagine the fashion, you can imagine the portraiture, the stories there. It's great. It looks clean. It looks fairly functional, but
you were sort of sighing there, just saying, you know, the magazine you wish you'd done. I'll leave everyone in suspense. We're going to go to a break, but you can think about what is that magazine that we're waiting for Stephen Ledger Lomas to launch. You're listening to The Stack. We're back in a moment.
As our first ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living, begins hitting shelves around the world, so too do our editors take to the road to celebrate the launch of this 408-page survey on how to live well. We're visiting our favourite bookstores and retailers in 15 cities across the globe to meet subscribers, contributors, and fans. Join us for a glass of wine, a spot of shopping, and a chance to meet the team. To find out where we're headed in September and October, keep an eye on book.monocle.com.
And we're almost at the end of the program. I think we've got about 7 or 8 minutes. I'm not going to make you talk about Lucky Peach for 7 or 8 minutes, Penny. But I see that is one of the titles that you brought in today. Why? And it's interesting where that magazine is in terms of evolution at this point as well.
Yeah, well, there's a kind of non-stop food magazines being published because it's not as expensive as to shoot fashion, presumably. But I picked it up because everybody had been talking about it, and also, you know, a lot of people talking about where this was the kind of origins for many of the food magazines that are coming out. Mm. And it's not the most current one. It's the summer issue I've got here. And it had "For Women!" exclamation mark written on it, which seemed intriguing. And since, you know, in interviews, that's the question I'm always asked, being a women's magazine, about what I think about the kind of current trend in pop feminism, kind of both online women's journalism and also in women's magazines. I was kind of amazed to see their gender issue. I mean, I actually don't know what to make of it. It's got a sort of editor's letter by the female member of staff saying, hey, we're always accused of being really dudey, so just to show you that in fact we do have a female member of staff. And then it kind of proceeds to profile one woman, and then it has all the kind of rooster testicle soups and, you know, the pictures with Playboy in it, and just kind of wonder what the sort of gender, what it's trying to say, I don't know. But it did make me think about a lot of the kind of women's food magazines that are coming out, like, for instance, Wolf magazine that's come out in London, and what this kind of combination of food and feminism, and whether that's a new shift or it's just kind of every single box being ticked. I don't know what you think. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen Wolf yet, but I want to go back to Lucky Peach because it's, I always end up picking it up, and oftentimes it's, you know, it's when I'm in the States, but I'm always sort of left sort of, you know, what am I supposed to do with this? And I can never quite engage with it. And, you know, if I'm honest, I can't quite see what all of the hype is about. I can see how it sort of found its way and it can outrage this and that. But, and there you're pointing at a story, which I can't see the headline.
What? Stag Pizzle Soup.
Right, there you go.
Yeah, it's a sort of jackass kind of atmosphere, isn't it? Is it meant to speak to the kind of unreconstructed guy? I don't know.
You know, the unreconstructed guy is not buying that magazine. Whereas I think if you look at a title which we've talked about before in this program, which is Beef in Germany, and Beef is incredibly successful because it's about throwing things on the grill, but it is user-friendly, and it has that maybe sort of sense of outrage a little bit. Tell me about Wolf, because I'd heard about it, but I hadn't seen it yet. And
that's beautiful.
It's from the same family, I think, as Beat magazine, which is a kind of music fanzine by Hannah Hanra. Are they not both art directed by a designer? Is Dean, isn't it?
Dean does Beat. I'm not sure, actually, Wolf. Yeah, I know that Eleanor Morgan's one of the editors at Wolf. It's Guardian. Really beautiful, actually.
And it's free. So where did you stumble across it?
I was sent it, but there was a kind of launch. She works at The Guardian, does she not?
And she does, yeah.
I think that a lot of the contributors are the kind of that family. But it's interesting that the contributors are around those kind of pop feminist writers, like the kind of Eva Wiseman, and I don't know if Catelyn's in there, but certainly Rebecca Nicholson, etc. And it's kind of, what's interesting for me is that whole question about women's magazines and whether the reason that women's magazines don't get awards, etc., is that they're so often writing about the female experience that it doesn't kind of communicate beyond that kind of agenda. But what's interesting for me is this kind of collision of food and feminism, but it seems to kind of expand outside itself. I mean, it's not perfect, I think. Editorially, it can stand some more development, I think, but it's a kind of interesting stab in a kind of fascinating area.
We haven't spent a lot of time, I mean, talking about just, you know, what has happened with Free. And you know, London's a very good example where you have the likes of Shortlist and Stylist and things like this, which have, I guess, done very well for themselves, if the indication of the stacks of them at any sort of BA departure lounge is anything to go by. And so you wonder if this is going to be slightly, you know, the thinking, you know, man and woman's, this next generation of free publishing in London. Because what I do like about it is that the back is that there is room for proper were sort of fractional ads. They didn't venture very far at the Guardian's front door to get Shrimpies to take the outside back cover.
They just love the Donald Durker illustration.
Yeah,
of it,
which is great for the back of the magazine. But there is something exciting that, you know, can you have this type of journal and can a new startup restaurant, you know, just pay maybe the £500 or the £250 to get in there? And actually, this is just really interesting where, I know, somehow, you know, that's what digital can't do.
Indeed. I think that, in fact, it would be exciting to see digital try and rework the idea of the classified. I'd love to see a website with a kind of a sidebar of classified illustration-based adverts, the ones that you would see in Vogue in the 1980s and those terrible layouts. I can't convince my colleagues of it, but I feel there's something there.
No, I think there's absolutely, and it is odd when you sort of look at everything that, you know, all classifieds, you know, go online and it's just, you know, a sea of horrendous links. And it's not, I don't know what I would do if I was out looking for a job as a journalist today, but it used to be so exciting getting The Guardian and finding sort of the small ad if you wanted to work at Mentor Films in London or somewhere else. And, well, thankfully, I haven't had to go onto a job site for a while. But anyway, for those who are listening and are not in London, where does Beat sit in the market here as well?
Beat's another free title. I believe they give it away in various boutiques and restaurants around London. I think... I mean, it's of the heritage of The Face. I think it's Hannah Hanra who used to work at The Face. I might be wrong in saying that.
She's a beauty editor at ID, I think.
That's right. But it's a free newspaper. I think it's Beautifully Art Director. We were talking about in the waiting room before. It's wonderful photography. Ryan McGinley's a very good-looking contributor, Alison McClellan. It's really just a celebration of music, and I think it's the perfect form of independent publishing for me.
Yeah, it's scrappy and it's ambitious and it's got big muscles, I think. It's really exciting, those girls, I think.
Just before we went to that last break, we're almost to the end of the program, Stephen. If you were to venture out and launch a magazine, without giving away sort of maybe the grand business idea, do you have a magazine in you?
Gosh, I was going to say food and feminism. No, I've always wanted to celebrate the British countryside, but I don't know whether that has the legs. I think basing something in the great outdoors, I think it would be wonderful.
No, I think there's definitely room. I was at this wonderful little newsstand down in Wales a couple of weeks ago, and there are all of these, you know, very sort of, you know, niche titles that belong to lots of, you know, organizations and federations, and they were interesting, and yet with a bit of help and a bit of photography and you know, and a few other things, you think it could be amazing. And I know we don't have time to get to that journal, but I mean, it's even time for that to sort of, you know, move on and get a bit more mud around the edges of the page, I think.
But isn't that amazing? That's where photography started. So armchair travel and people selling carte de visites. It's funny, we're kind of going back to the mid-19th century with our kind of longing for a kind of pastoral idyll in images.
Hey, Martin, just before we go, aside from that, I just want to talk about, for people who experience the magazine, what is happening with the gentlewoman community? Is there anything, any way for listeners to engage? And is there a specific place they need to go?
Yeah, well, we're just starting. Of course, there has been an online presence, but we're developing that, and basically what we're doing is answering the questions that were coming mainly to our Facebook and trying to kind of create an online, a sort of more evolved online presence. But it's been long my desire to have a kind of editorialized reader experience. So previously, in the front of our issue, where what we call the modernisms, the Q&A chats, we're going to start doing those with our readers. I'm really excited. So people that sign up, we're going to leaf through them. And if they tell us something interesting about themselves, we're going to start doing Q&A and really nice visuals with a sort of star reader each month. And I'm kind of exciting to kind of create that into a community. But yeah, we're going to be doing readers events and kind of working towards a ladies club kind of thing that will happen internationally. And I like the idea of online being a virtual place for real things to happen, real magazines, real people, real events. So that's the kind of online concept.
And it reminds me of, if you remember Look and Learn magazine, or maybe you're both a little bit too young for that, but I remember getting that in Manitoba, and there was always like the star pen pal of the month. And they did something about, you know, this far off land that they were from. It was incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I once won £5 for such a letter.
There you go. And that brings us to the end of this program. As ever, Penny Martin from The Gentlewoman, thanks very much for joining us. And of course, Stephen Ledger-Lomas from MAP. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant, and we've had Chris Fitch running the controls behind the glass today. As mentioned a little bit earlier, we're going to be in Melbourne with our program next week. And of course, then after that, we'll be heading back to base here in London. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, do drop us a note to info@monocle.com. And of course, you can always listen to us again via Time Shift, also on iTunes as well. But now for me, Tyler Brulé, it's goodbye.